Welcome again, dear listener, to the Religions Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Gardner. It's a privilege to speak to you again. I am surprised at how quickly 2 weeks passes. This podcast is released every 2 weeks, and it's time for another one, which means it's been 2 weeks since the last one. So, it's surprising how quickly time passes, which brings me to the topic for today's podcast. It's all about time today. And anyway, we'll get to that in a second. If you're new to the podcast, what we do here is we talk about truth, and we don't segregate the scientific or the religious. We celebrate both truths and both areas of learning truth, and we're happy for both of them, and we're grateful for the things that we are learning through both. Our spiritual nature, if we give it leave to do so, usually tells us that we have a limited time on earth, and it reminds us of that, and it prompts us to do things to make the most of that time. I'm reminded of a phrase from one of my favorite movies. It's called The Village by M. Night Shyamalan, if I even say his name correctly. It's spelled in a way that, I don't say it the way it's spelled, but I don't think he does either. So anyway, in the movie The Village, one of the characters, one of the elders of the village, Edward Walker, as people are gathered together at a table for a feast, he tells them, or he says out loud, "We are grateful for the time we have been given." And you know what? I think we all are. The knowledge that the clock is ticking is a motivating force for us, and it should prompt us to be grateful for what little bit of time we actually have to do what we want to do. On the other hand, the scientific use of time is it's an essential tool for science. It's a critical component of some of the most common measurements, like speed, for example, which we have a distance component. Miles, for example, divided by time, which would be hours, miles per hour. Or if you're talking ballistics, maybe feet per second or meters per second if you're in a physics class. And of course, we're using the universal measurements. So we use it for a lot of things. We also use it to calculate how fast a computer works. Hertz is actually the inverse of a time measurement. So if we say gigahertz, that's billions of times per second. And that's how we use that's how we use time in science. It's used to measure a lot of different things. I'm reminded of a song that Shakira sang way back in her first album. I believe it was her first album. Pies Descalzos is the name of the song, which means barefooted or bare feet. In that song, she sang the following words, which I think are classic. Construiste un mundo exacto de acabados tan perfectos, cada cosa calculada en su espacio, en su tiempo. Yo que soy un caos completo, las entradas, las salidas, los nombres y las medidas no me caben en los sesos. And in English, that might say something like, "You built an exact world with details so perfect, each thing calculated in its space and in its time. I am completely chaotic, so the ins and the outs, the names and the measurements don't fit in my brain." Well, that was back in the 90s. And if back in the 90s, things weren't fitting in Shakira's brain, or whoever wrote the song, you can just imagine how things would be today, with how much things have changed since then. So, anyway, let's get started. Today's podcast is not a story, as it usually is. Instead, it may be several stories. I'm going to be interviewing Nathan Hall. We'll be talking about time, the ins and outs of time, where it came from, why we measure it, what it's good for. Sit back and relax. It's going to be kind of a history lesson today. We'll talk about how things came about, and it's going to be very interesting. I have a lot of fun talking to Nathan, and I think you'll see that in the show. Also, please stay tuned after the lesson. We'll have a sneak preview of the next episode of the Religions Podcast, or at least a trailer, so to speak. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk to you in just a little bit. Here's the interview with Nathan Hall. Well, today we are interviewing Nathan Hall. How are you doing today, Nathan?
Good. How are you doing?
You know, I'm not too bad. Other than all the smoke outside, I don't know how many of our listeners are in a smoky area right now, but I know we sure are. And I would be happy for the yellow sky to clear up. I don't know about you.
Yes, agreed. And my allergies along with it.
Yeah, that, no kidding. That too. So, Nathan, our listeners don't know you. And would you take a minute and tell us who you are?
Sure. My name is Nathan Hall.
I did that part already.
Oh, right. I don't know. What do you want to know about me?
Well, what did you go to school for? What do you know? What's your profession?
Okay. So my degrees are actually in business. I have a bachelor's in business management and a master's in management and leadership, which is kind of a hybrid of business management and behavioral psychology. It was a really fun degree.
behavioral psychology.
Yeah.
That's a headbender right there.
It's a lot of learning how groups develop and how groups work together and how to lead groups and lead people and, you know, what good leaders are and good followers are and, you know, the psychology behind all of that. So my primary interests are actually in teaching, but it's, as you know, it's hard to make a living and support a family in teaching something like science.
Yes, it is.
So I work in marketing, which I've worked in for many years, doing various things and owning my own businesses and that kind of stuff. So,
excellent. And this building we're in now, this used to be, well, this is where I brought my car to have you service it for a while when you were self-employed.
Yep.
As a mechanic, I guess you'd call yourself back then.
Yep, that is true. I am also an auto repair technician. I'm kind of a jack of all trades.
Yeah, but this building has evolved a lot since those days. Yep. What's going on here?
So when the pandemic kind of hit our area, especially, as you know, was hit really, really bad because of the agricultural issues, the supply chain issues that kind of hit that whole sector.
Right.
And so because of that, our business in particular was also hit really hard. And, you know, there were a lot of people who weren't able or were afraid to bring their vehicles in and get them fixed. You know, lots of farmers, you know, didn't want to get their vehicles fixed on a whim anymore because they weren't sure what the future held.
Let's let our employees do that. And
yeah,
hopefully the twine will hold it together until we need it.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So so I went and got a different job and, you know, doing marketing and that kind of stuff again, back kind of where my degrees actually are, and decided to turn this into a place to teach science to kids, because that's a passion that I have. It's something that I really love doing, but
something we have in common.
Yeah. but I haven't had the opportunity to do. I used to teach in Kansas City for a company called Mad Science out there, and they're a great company to check out. But there's nothing quite like that out here, so I wanted to get something started out here.
Mad Science Idaho, or does it have a different name?
No, I really like what Mad Science does. I thought about doing a franchise of Mad Science, but there are some different things that I wanted to do with this business too. So I'm calling this Lab Coats with a Z, LabCoatz.
Lab Coats, that's cool.
Yep. So it's,
I like it.
Lab Coats STEM Exploration Experience is the full name.
Thank you for that introduction. So, don't you think it's about time we begin talking about our topic for today, Nathan?
Yeah, it is about time.
It is about time. Is the topic for our conversation today, is time, in case you didn't clue in from the title of the podcast and our puns. time. We all know we've got to be to our meetings on time, make it to church on time, you know, all these things that we do on time, and time is something which, in our modern society, is very important. Or at least we think it is, and we keep track of time on our watches, on our cell phones. But let's talk a little bit today about, wait a minute, where did this whole thing of time come from, and how did it start out? So, anciently, Nathan, how did mankind start keeping time, and why did we do it?
So, let's address the why first. So, imagine that you're a caveman, right?
And I can imagine that. That's pretty close, actually.
Yeah, luckily our viewers can't see me or they would think I was a caveman. so imagine that you're a caveman, right? And you're trying to, you know, you're trying to predict life, right? Are you going to need a fur covering today to even stay alive, or are you going to be warm today, right?
Is it a good day to go out in a loincloth, you know?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Right. You know, being able to predict weather was a very, very important part of life just in general. You know, for preparation for winter, preparations for summer, right? Those kinds of things. And especially as agriculture, you know, as farming started to become a thing, a technology that was used, it was really, really important to be able to know when to plant certain things and when certain things would grow and wouldn't grow and when rain was going to come and when rain wouldn't come and
sure.
Those types of things. And so in order to be able to predict those cycles, you had to have some way of measuring those cycles. And that's kind of the origin of the necessity for time.
Okay, makes sense.
Timekeeping.
So kind of to keep track of the seasons then. We know when autumn is, when spring is, and so that's how it started.
Right. Those are just concepts, you know, that we think of now as autumn and spring or whatever.
Right. Right. Like then it was time to plant and time to harvest. And
right. Then it was, ugh.
Ugh, it's cold outside.
Yeah. Ugh, stick seed in ground.
Well, we've changed a little bit. So what's the difference in our time today versus time back then?
Well, that's an interesting question. So we measure time completely different now than we used to. And, you know, we'll get into more about how we measure or how we used to measure time and how we measure time now. Now we measure time with radiation cycles on specific types of
cesium atoms.
Yeah, exactly. Right. On a specific atom, right? Which is totally different than what we used to measure time by.
Yeah. Caveman didn't know about cesium atoms.
Right. If he came across one, he wouldn't even know what he was looking at.
Right.
So we measure time completely differently now. Now time is used for all kinds of stuff that was never even conceived of back then, right? We use it to do everything from calculating,
length of our foot races against each other.
Or, yeah. To tuning,
time around the track.
To tuning a piano, to,
right.
You know, tuning musical instruments that have been invented within the last few hundred years or, you know, a couple thousand years, whatever, all the way down to, the cycles of nanoprocessors in our computer hardware and, you know,
oh boy, yeah,
that kind of stuff. So we use time keeping and time tracking for all kinds of things now that it wasn't used for before. And therefore the necessity for it to be much more precise is also very, very important. So, well, and even down to things like watching a movie in your living room, there's very important timing that's involved in that too. Not only the timing of what you're viewing, you know, whether you're looking at, whether your TV can display at 60 hertz or 120 hertz, but also what the video source was shot at. Was it shot at 24 frames a second, or was it shot at, you know, 60 frames a second or 120 frames a second, and how is that displayed back to you?
Right.
So there's all kinds of interesting stuff that Ugg the caveman didn't have to worry about back then. But the interesting thing is that as time evolved, when we first started tracking time, you know, the first measurements were basically just a stick in the ground, looking at a shadow, you know, called a shadow clock.
So that's pretty technologically advanced if we don't even know about it, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't think most people would even know how to deal with a shadow clock, you know, if everything, you know, a post-apocalyptic scenario, right? All of our electronics stop functioning. I don't think most people would know how to track time with a stick in the ground.
Right. Yes, definitely. If my phone dies or my watch dies, I'm going to have trouble with that stick in the ground figuring out how to make my 9:30 appointment.
Right. Right.
Well, interestingly enough, I'm going to post in the show notes a shadow clock that a nephew of mine in Australia kept track of, and one that I kept track of at the same time. On the same day, but of course different times because he has the sun shining on him at a different time than I do. But I'll post that in the show notes for people who are interested about what a shadow clock would look like and how that worked. So that would be interesting. So what other technologies and what other things happened that made time something that we had to keep more close, you know, more close track of?
Right. As people started kind of wandering further and further from home, you know, Ugg was no longer just walking outside of his cave and killing whatever hopped by him and then and then dragging it back in, right? Eventually they needed to venture further away. And in order to do that, you have to have some way to know how to get back home. Unless you're completely nomadic, in which case you still probably want some way to navigate something so that you know that you're going to get back to a spot that's safe. Not only knowing if he had enough time to make it back, but also knowing how far he had gone and in what directions, right? You can measure, you know, for short distances, it's easy enough to measure your steps, right? You can measure footsteps, you can count your footsteps, that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, you can measure distances to a point, but when you're traveling long distances for long periods of time, it's a lot more difficult, especially if you know, if you're a caveman and you wander far enough to the edge of your island and then decide to build a canoe and go to a different island. and you're gone overnight, right? All of a sudden, you don't have the sun to follow anymore, and you have to follow the stars. And you can kind of follow a general direction, but how do you know if you're getting close to your destination? What if you have to sail around something? Do you know when to turn? Do you know where you're at when you turn? Do you know that you're going to be turning towards land? Are you turning away from it, right?
Sure.
And so in order to measure those kinds of things, you have to have some kind of specific interval of time, and you have to have a way to measure your speed. And so navigation was a really, really big reason for keeping track of time.
Okay. So I'm not so unique when I say, hey, I'm 20 minutes away. Okay.
Anyway, so, you know, the technology, not only the need for timekeeping developed, but also the technology for the ability to keep time, the technology for timekeeping devices developed as well. And this is what I really find fascinating. I enjoy collecting clocks and watches and all kinds of stuff, and old machines in general.
Technology.
Yeah. I really love the idea that there are ways to do things without electricity and, you know, with repeatability in certain ways, right? And so, you know, mechanical watches are by far one of my favorite pieces of technology.
Well, with reason, they're fascinating to watch, if nothing else.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But there are very, very interesting ways that I've found that ancient civilizations used to keep time. One, for example, was a water clock, essentially, which basically was imagine like a rain gauge, but with a large vessel of water above it with a hole of a specific diameter in the bottom of it. And so there was a specific known rate that the water would flow from the top vessel into the rain gauge, right?
Insert sound effect. Blop, blop. Right.
There's a bathroom over there if you need to record the sound effect. We can...
Hey, no, I'm good. I can find that elsewhere.
You know, so from there they were able to, you know, measure time by as a function of how much water was in this gauge, right? And similarly, some societies used candles, and they would have candles that were made of a specific material with a specific burn rate, essentially. You know,
right.
There were a specific material, specific diameter, and a specific length, and they would stick those in a specific base that had graduations on the back of it, and they'd burn the candle, and from there...
minute marks or hour marks or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. And from there, I would imagine it was hours, I don't really know for sure, but from
seems
there...
Seems like it if you're looking at a candle.
Right.
It doesn't
very
seem
quickly
like it would
burning
burn.
Candle.
Yeah. Unless it's like super fast blubber burning.
Right.
I don't know. So the water clock sounds a lot to me like the same idea as the hourglass. So were those kind of similarly created for timing? Or like the minute timers that we have in games and things like that, where you turn it over and it,
yeah, like the
sand runs through the minute glass or the hourglass,
yeah,
or whatever.
The little hourglass egg timer kind of things.
Right.
Yeah, so the concept is very, very similar, right? With the hourglass, you know the rate at which... the sand or whatever, the sediment falls through the glass, right? And so based on that, you can get very specific intervals of, you know, measuring your time.
Right.
So one of the things that I've always found fascinating is, I say ancient, not really all that ancient, but sea travel, right? And I say ancient, really what I mean is before we had electricity and engines,
right,
and, you know, internal combustion engines and that
archaic
kind of stuff.
Archaic things before electricity.
Right. Anyway, so one of the things that I found fascinating was how they navigated with those ships. You know, they would track their direction and their speed, and, you know, their direction, they would use compasses and sextants and that kind of thing.
their speed, they would use ropes to measure knots, and that's a whole other discussion. But the
40 knots.
Yeah, but as long as they knew, 40 knots would be a real clip for a sailboat.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a bad wind right there. Yeah,
that would be...
that's strikingly close. If I'm not mistaken, knots end up pretty close to miles per hour, don't they?
Pretty similar, yeah.
So, yeah, 40 knots is about 40 miles an hour. That's booking on a sailboat. Would be, that's booking on any boat, really.
Yeah, that would be pretty... that'd be intense on a ship like that. But they would measure their speed, you know, at a certain time or whatever, and then they would measure the hours, and, you know, they knew about how fast they were going for an hour, and they knew how many hours they were traveling, and they knew in what direction, and so that's how they kept track of where they were.
They learned how to divide.
Yep, and as long as they knew...
Or they knew how before then, obviously.
Right, as long as they knew where they had come from... And they kept track of how long they were traveling and in what direction and at what speed, they knew how to get to wherever they were going. And they could get close enough to do it visually at that point. And then, you know, or they could track things by stars to track their approximate position to get closer if they got off course. And then they could just get to wherever they were going. And then from there, they knew where they were leaving from again. And the cycle started all over.
Well, that's pretty fascinating, actually. So... A lot of the development of time has been from exploration.
Right.
So that kind of forced our hand into getting better time measurements.
Right.
And distance measurements too, probably.
Yeah.
Would make sense.
Well, and if you think about it, we do pretty similar things these days. You know, if you imagine that you're going on a trip, right? Which probably most people don't do this anymore. But, you know, years ago, before we had Google Maps to to just guide our way everywhere, we would...
Piece of paper map.
Yep, we'd pull out our atlas, right?
And
we'd flip through the pages and figure out kind of the distance that we were going to be going, and we'd estimate a certain speed and divide and figure out about how long it was going to take us to get there, right? And how long, you know, until we got to certain towns for gas stops and whatever, right?
Yes.
One other fascinating thing about the hourglasses, you know, time is very dependent on specific intervals, right? It has to be very close to exact cycles. You know, you were calling them oscillations earlier.
That's an important concept, I think, that we need to know to keep time.
Right. And so, you know, whether it's rotations around the sun or whatever, right, we need to know specifically when our cycle, quote unquote, our oscillation or our whatever is starting over again. And so on these ships, they would use these hourglasses, and they'd have to hang the hourglasses so that the hourglass was always pointing straight down and was always level, because otherwise, if it waved back and forth with the ship, the sand would
falling at
back
an angle
and forth, and it would change the rate, and all of a sudden you've lost half an hour and you don't know it because your hourglass is off all the time.
Well, that makes sense, because at a certain angle, sand won't flow anymore.
Right.
That's why it stays in dunes. You know, it's not going to flow down as well at a 30 degree angle as it is a 90 degree angle, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. So they did that for, let's keep it regular.
Right.
Otherwise, the time will vary depending on the roughness of the seas, right?
Right.
So, yes, speaking of oscillations, I think that's important to timekeeping because, you know, we have the cycle of a year, which is an oscillation or a rotation of the Earth around the sun. And then we have the oscillation of a day, which is one rotation of the Earth. And the sun is back to the same spot again in the sky, or approximately, because it might move north or south. But, you know, relatively, it's in the same spot east and west.
Right.
That's part of timekeeping, though, is an oscillation. If we didn't have repeating patterns, there would be no time.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Key. So, but it does appear, though, time, especially originally, I mean, it's tied in with astronomy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about, like you said, you know, we have the cycle of the Earth spinning around, right? Spinning on its axis, so the position of the sun in the sky relative to where we're standing, and also the position of the Earth around the sun for the year, right, which kind of corresponds with the seasons.
Right.
And that kind of gives us a basis for being able to break down certain certain cycles of time and understand kind of when things are going to happen and predict things on a schedule.
And that's a natural, automatically built into the Earth system timekeeper.
Yeah, exactly.
We just needed to clue in to the fact that it was already there and already existing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, that exact reason is why the whole stick in the ground works to keep time. Right,
exactly.
And so maybe the first guy to go stick a stick in the ground and try to track its shadow didn't really understand exactly what was going on. But the concept is exactly the same.
Right. You know? And, the ancients, I don't think we can really give them enough credit for a lot of their understanding about how the sky moved, how the seasons worked and their grasp of astronomy. I was watching a history show the other day and they were talking about, well, not a history show, but an archaeologist.
Oh, yeah.
There's an archaeological documentary about El Castillo in the old Mayan communities, they call it. It's got another name too. El Castillo is what they call it, the locals. But they built a pyramid, which was perfectly timed. So at the equinox, the sun creates a snake coming down the staircase.
Interesting.
That's an amazing feat of architecture and getting everything together to have that happen at exactly the equinox.
Yeah.
So pretty amazing skill that was displayed in some of their timekeeping methods that I think today we have to marvel at because, well, we do pretty amazing things too. I mean, our computers are awesome, but that was amazing.
Right. Well, we've built computers to replicate those things on demand, right?
Yeah.
And they had to do all that kind of stuff by hand when they needed it. It's fascinating and amazing that they were able to figure that out and do that, you know?
And, something you just said is kind of interesting. In our whole timekeeping efforts, they're all coming off of natural phenomenon that's already in place. Time's already being kept.
Yeah.
The world is keeping time. Yeah. Whether it's the oscillations of energy level states in the cesium atom or
right.
or if it's the oscillations of the Earth and its path through the sky and orbiting the sun, those things already existed. We're just kind of cluing into those and capturing those for our own use.
Yeah. So the way I always think about it is that time is really just a measurement of change, really. When we think about things changing, some things change at a specific rate over and over and over and over and over, right? And so you know that from the time that you cut a tulip that looks a certain way, and you go and you put it inside in a certain corner at a specific temperature in whatever fluid it is, right? You know what it's going to look like in 3 days.
Right.
And you have a general idea. Well, now imagine that somebody goes and puts an artificial flower in its place one day.
Oh, dirty trick.
Yeah, all of a sudden you'd have no idea because your grasp of time is based on assumptions of changes that you have seen be consistent forever. And all of a sudden, you take that away.
That flower just totally blew it out of the water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've taken away all of the predictable changes in your life, right? And so now, all of a sudden, you have no concept of time anymore. Right. That's also why children have no concept of time in general, because they have no context for it, right?
It just takes a really long time for the cookie to bake.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But and they Christmas don't, to come.
But they don't bake cookies every day. And if they did, I have a 2.5-year-old. I guarantee that if we baked cookies every day at a specific time, he would know exactly how long it was going to take. Because we make him chicken nuggets in the microwave, and he knows exactly how long it will take in the microwave. When we put it in, he hears the button beep when we hit start, and a mere seconds before it finishes, he's up standing at the microwave saying, "Is it ready? Is it done?"
Oh, that's funny. That is funny. So, yeah, he would measure time intervals in cooking of chicken nuggets.
Yeah, exactly.
Intervals instead
exactly.
of hours and minutes or
right.
whatever.
But we as adults, right, we've lived our whole lives on, well, a circadian rhythm, an internal clock, right, which is a whole nother topic for this.
Sure.
But we've lived our entire lives on this circadian rhythm of, we wake up and we're awake for a certain amount of time and the sun comes up at this time and it goes down at this time.
Uh-huh.
And in this season, we know that it's going to come up at about this time and it's going to go down at about this time.
Right.
My
watch will tell me sunset and sunrise,
right? Yeah, exactly. And we've been around for, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, right? Like, and as human adults, we just get used to those cycles. And so the longer we go, the better concept of time we have because we have more context for it.
Makes sense. This leads into conjecture for me because in many scriptures it talks about how time is for us, but the Lord has a different time frame than we do. So one has to speculate and say, so is time and all these things that we're talking about, is that an invention that has to do with the matter and whatnot that we live in for us? And he's somehow outside of that? That could be a topic that we could really get into, but
I don't know.
That's big speculation.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder too, you know, okay, think about, you know, we have these standard units of measurement. You know, something that you and I talked about before we started recording was right. That societies kind of have these uses for standardized measurement, but only when two societies come together, right?
Right. It matters because we have to have the same time frames to be able to relate with each other.
Exactly. And that's not only true of time, but it's also true of, you know, length measurements or temperature measurements.
Not in the United States, though, because we still use feet and inches instead of meters.
Right. Well, let's talk to
we're above that.
Let's talk to the Mars Global Surveyor team and see how that worked out for them.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so it does matter when we're talking to international groups.
Yeah, if you need some context for that, just Google the Mars Global Surveyor disaster.
Yes.
There was some
disaster.
Conversion issues there. Anyway, so, you know, these two societies have no reason to have standardized measurements until they come together, right? But even so, you know, we think about these standardized measurements as being universal, but they're really not, right? I mean, we think of centimeters as being like the universal standard, right? Even in Star Trek. Right, we think about, you know, everybody talks about things in centimeters in Star
sure.
Trek, right? Or in meters or kilometers or whatever, right? But, we really have no reason to believe that outside of this universe, like outside of this solar system, that there'd be any reason to use that, right? Now, imagine that from a celestial perspective, right? So we've
okay.
just talked about other ways that you could measure something like time, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, you could measure it by the number of times that you can empty a cup of water, right? Or you can measure it in candles, or you can measure it in, you know,
tulip length or tulip growth.
Yeah,
tulip
wilting, right?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I went through four tulips, you know, like, well, what does that mean, right? You know, you talk about moons, right? Like four moons. Well, what does that mean? You know, four moons of time. I don't know. Like, are we talking full moons or are we talking about every time the moon came up every day? Right.
Right.
And so without some kind of, common context, it's really hard to describe what time means. Now imagine trying to come up with some kind of common ground context with a God
who has told you that time is for us and not for him.
Right.
And he's outside of time.
Yeah. And I'm sure that in some way he does measure time. I would think that's also speculation, right?
Yeah.
But you would
think, can't know for sure, I guess.
You would think that in some way he measures time, but we would have no way of having some kind of common context with a God, right? Like, he's got such a different view of the universe and of existence than we do that even if he tried to describe it, we'd have no way of knowing what that meant.
Like the verse in Doctrine and Covenants where the Lord tells us, I tell you this that you may understand. He puts
right.
it in terms so we can understand, but it's something really that he's basically saying, you won't understand it.
Right, yeah.
Unless I put it in these common terms for you.
Right.
And, yeah. So, Nathan, it makes sense why we have our days and we have, you know, years. That all makes sense. How do we get something that seems kind of arbitrary, like, why are there 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so that one's actually really interesting. You know, we tend to think of measurements as being divided up into tens because so much of our measurements are based on a base 10.
A
base 10 system, right?
10 fingers, right?
Because we have 10 fingers.
Easy
yeah.
to count.
Right, and so, you know, we have 10 fingers, and that's why we tend to think of things as being base 10. And so I always kind of assumed that it was arbitrary also that things were divided by 60. But it turns out the Sumerians actually developed a system that was also based on counting on our hands.
So we're talking like, you know, 4,000 years ago, right?
Yeah,
or more, probably. Probably 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up, but I mean, many, many thousands of years, right?
Okay, so a long time this has been done.
Long time ago. And they based their system on the same idea of being able to count on your hands. But theirs was a little bit different because they can count to 12 on one hand.
Whoa, what kind of magic did they use? How many fingers did they have back then?
Extra fingers, right?
On one hand.
Anytime somebody would die, they'd hack off all their fingers. I've heard of the six, sew them on.
The right? Six-fingered man, I understand, because I've seen The Princess Bride, but how did this 12-fingered man come into play?
My name is Inigo Montoya.
Yeah.
Do you begin all your conversations this way? if you hold out your hand, and our listeners can do this, you know, they can follow along, hold out your hand, and you're going to count with your thumb.
Okay.
Okay, so you're going to use your thumb to count.
Thumb is the pointer?
Yep, so you're not going to count anything on your thumb, right? You're just going to use your thumb to point.
Okay. Makes sense.
So now, we're going to count to 12 on our hand, right?
Okay.
You see...
I'm by my index finger, is that where I need to be?
So fold your thumb over to your pinky
real quick. Okay.
And just imagine you've got... Well, I say imagine. Don't imagine. You
really
should have knuckles.
This is a science lab right now.
I hope you don't have to imagine that you have knuckles. Hopefully you still have joints in your fingers.
Well, I haven't lost this finger, even though I do wear a ring, and I haven't caught it on the basketball net yet, so we're good.
That's true. Yeah, some of the farmers in our area might not be able to count to 12 still.
This
on
is
their
true.
Fingers.
Missing digits or part digits.
Yeah, if you've been a woodshop teacher for any amount of time, you probably can't do this.
So I'm at the
pinky. You'll count to 11. Anyway, so...
Time will be different for you.
Yeah. So you'll start, and there are three segments of each finger, right?
Okay, yeah.
Because in between your knuckles, you know, you've got the tip of your finger, you have the middle of your finger, and you have the base of your finger right near your palm.
Right next to the hand, yeah, yep. That makes sense.
And so you'll count 1, 2, 3 on your pinky.
There's my pinky, yeah.
4, 5, 6 on your ring finger.
Right.
7, 8, 9 on your middle finger. 10, 11, 12 on your index finger, right?
Okay, so that's 12. How did the 60 come in?
So because you can use your other hand also, right?
Oh.
And now you use your other hand, and you use just the digits on your other hand to count how many times you have counted to 12.
Okay, so I stick my thumb up since I counted to 12 once.
Yep.
Okay.
And so now, if you counted to 12 again, you'd be at 24, and you'd hold out your index finger.
And that'd be my, okay.
And then, you know, so on and so on until you have counted to 60 five times, or sorry, 12.
12 five times to get
which
60.
Which is 60, yeah.
Okay, so base 60, that's an ingenious counting system.
Yeah, and it turns out that they actually based their currency and their distance measurements and all kinds of things on a base 60, because then they could do quick math on their fingers, right?
All the way to 60, not just 10.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. They didn't even have to take off their shoes to count to 20 like we do.
12-fingered Babylonians here. No problem.
Right. Yeah. There were no woodshop teachers among the Sumerians.
Oh, geez. Well, that's pretty cool. So tying in with the topic of time, there's this all-important topic. So yeah, you lived for a time in Arizona, which means you lived in the celestial. a more celestial state in which they do not change time forward and back every 6 months or 9 and 3 or whatever it is now with our changing of the time and daylight savings. You did not have daylight saving time in Arizona.
No, it was such a weird thing. Well, so I grew up in Texas and then moved to Arizona and then moved back out of Arizona, right?
Right.
But it did not take long to get used to the idea of not having daylight savings time.
Oh, yeah.
And when I moved back out of Arizona, it was the weirdest thing.
Like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, this is very strange.
And there are so many people, locals, that it drives them crazy, and we really wish that we could do what Arizona does and just not do that. And then there are others that I speak with that think, well, but it's so nice in the summer because the sun doesn't set until 9:30.
Or 10.
Yeah. We're worried about the sun setting late. Well, that's artificial. See, I think of our time should be close to when the sun is at its zenith, which means it's at the highest point that it's going to get to in the sky. It should be noon. And we fail on both counts here in Idaho because, one, we're at the far west, we're toward the far western reaches of our time zone. And when we do daylight savings, it pushes the time, the sun setting way back to like 9:30. But it also means local noon is almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which drives me crazy. So there's a pet peeve. Now if somebody wants to know how to bug me, they can just tell me it's time for lunch at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I guess. But yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine. But it leads me to the question, why do we have time zones in the first place, Nathan?
So time zones are an interesting thing because if you think about it, you know, imagine that you have, well, just like what you said, you've got a nephew, was it, that was using a shadow clock at
right,
the same time.
In Australia.
Yep. If you and him had been looking at your clocks at exactly the same time, what would you have been seeing?
Oh, that's a good thing. Kainoa would have seen, if I was seeing my shadow, he would have seen probably nothing.
Right.
Depending on what time of the day it was.
Because
toward evening time, he would have had some morning sun, but yeah, he'd have been in nighttime.
Right. It would have been in the dark.
Right.
Because, you know, if we're looking at time as being a function of where the sun is in the sky, then depending on where you're at on the Earth, you know, in this circle, on this globe, then it's going to be in a different spot for each person, depending on where you're at. Now, that means that we could, theoretically, have an infinite number of time zones, right? Because for each person, everywhere around the Earth, you know, we've got 360 degrees of globe, and we could divide that into an infinite number of positions.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, but that would be insane.
Right. Oh, shoot, ludicrous. I walked 3 steps to the west. We're in a different time zone.
Yeah, now it's a different time, right? You drive an hour one direction to work, and all of a sudden, your time isn't the same, right?
It makes sense.
It would be like a time gradient instead of a time zone, right? It would be constantly changing.
It would make it really hard to schedule meetings across time zones that way.
Yeah, exactly. It would be impossible to keep track of that.
And so that's why we don't have local noon at exactly local noon.
Right, so instead what we do is we chop that up and we make specific lines.
So we chop it into lines instead.
Yeah, so we divide it up, right? And I think the original idea was to divide it in specific lines, but then we used, you know, geographical markers and landmarks and that kind of stuff to kind of divide it up into these zones that make a little more sense. You know, we use rivers or state lines or that kind of thing.
Right, so we drive down to Nevada and all of a sudden we're in the Pacific time zone. And
right, yeah, exactly. Even though all we did was cross a state line.
Right.
But that makes it so that as we drive, you know, we're not constantly changing time just because of where we're at in relation to the rotation of the Earth near the sun, right? Like that would be insane.
Well, Nathan, thank you for spending some time with us today for this interview.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's been insightful and I know I've learned a lot and it's been fun talking to you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
And that's a wrap for our interview. Thanks again for downloading this episode. I'm glad that you joined us for this discussion, and I hope you learned a little bit about time. So as I promised, let me pose a question for you as kind of a teaser. If nothing else, it's something for you to think about, at least until the next podcast. Let me first frame this question with the scenario that we deal with. God loves us. We're told that in a plethora of spots in the scriptures. So we know that's true. Yet we are also taught very plainly in the scriptures that God will not save everyone. Some we have been told, quite frankly, will go to hell. One verse, if we read in the King James translation, sounds especially harsh, let me say that again. In John 3:36, it reads, "He that believeth on the Son hath everlasting life, and he that believeth not the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abideth on him." Now, depending on how you read that, that could mean that people who aren't baptized, or people who haven't even had the opportunity to hear about Jesus Christ in their lifetimes, are going to end up going to hell. And that applies to millions of people on the earth, even today, in this information age, which we would think that everybody has heard of him, but really, many corners of the earth have not. And, well, they're not going to see life. That doesn't seem just, does it? Does it seem consistent with a loving God? I don't think so. Especially given the context of life which I have experienced, in which most of the people that I observe that do bad things are kind of given a disadvantage in life, usually. Not always. Sometimes it's by choice. They're given every benefit and they still choose it. But a lot of times it's people who are raised by parents who didn't teach them correctly, or who had raised in bad neighborhoods, or had other difficulties. And they had to learn to do some things which most of us would not do as a means of survival. Would he condemn the children of drug addicts who learn to steal so that they can eat? Would he, you know, take these people and send them to hell? Yet, that seems to be what the scriptures say. And not to lessen the point, but to give another example, I have a dog here at the house. Gus is his name. He's a rescue dog. He was a gift to my wife from one of her good friends. And he was obviously beaten by a previous owner at some point. And though we were not there to witness it, we can see the evidence of that still today. If we put on a certain color of clothing, which triggers something in his mind, or an article of clothing like a hat, some coats. My son, when he puts on a black coat, boy, it will just scare him to death. Or certain noises. When one of my sons would play his tuba, it was a guaranteed run across the house scare issue. I feel compassion for this dog when things like this happen. And I don't like it, but typically I don't even really punish him if the fear overcomes him to the point where he loses control of his bladder. We just clean it up and move on. And this is me. And if I have compassion, isn't it reasonable that God would have compassion on people who are dealing with trauma in their own lives and lost control of themselves in a similar fashion? Well, I think so. But we can't deny what the scriptures say. Also, let's look at the opposite for a second. When we're still talking about the salvation of mankind, there's a danger, I think, in going too far in the other direction. In the Book of Mormon, a story is told of a man named Nehor who started to preach to the people of the Nephites and created many problems among the Nephites. And one of the teachings that he taught that Mormon, who's the compiler of the book of most of the Book of Mormon, tells us in Alma 1:4 that one of this man's teachings that was very damaging was, and I'll just quote it, "And he also testified unto the people that all mankind should be saved at the last day, and that they need not fear nor tremble, but that they might lift up their heads and rejoice. For the Lord had created all men, and had also redeemed all men, and in the end all men should have eternal life." Well, that sounds all nice and good, doesn't it? But anyone who's been a parent or a teacher of children will see pretty quickly the folly of this teaching. The message is clear. In that teaching, do whatever you want, you'll be saved. It doesn't matter. So, what's the answer? If neither one of those, you know, if we don't want God to send people to hell who seem like good people just in a bad situation, and if he's not going to save everyone, then how does that work out? Well, stay tuned next time, in 2 weeks, in the next podcast, and I'll reveal the answer to you. The truth, I think, is so powerful that it's one of the greatest truths ever revealed to mankind. And we'll talk about that in the next episode. Thanks again for downloading this episode. If you enjoyed it, please tell others about it. Please let us get the word out. Help us get the word out. Your sharing, reviewing, and rating of this show is greatly appreciated. Until next time, this is Stephen Gardner at Religions, wishing you a good day in which to learn truth.